Selkirk Grace. Some hae meat and canna eat, and some wad eat that want it. But we hae meat and we can eat, say let the Lord be thanked.
Oración de Selkirk. Algunos tienen pero no pueden, otros quieren pero no tienen. Pero nosotros tenemos y podemos, así que al Señor le agradecemos.
Hello, I'm Cliff Hansen, and this is All Holidays Matter, the podcast where you learn some of the surprising origins about the holidays you celebrate, learn about holidays that you don't celebrate but maybe should, and consider some holidays that you should stay way the hell away from. Really, the holiday I should be celebrating today is the snow day. There is so much snow here today and the last several days that it is a fucking mess, and I'm not able to actually get to our recording studio, which means I'm here alone. I don't have my guest today. I'm going to break this podcast up into two episodes, and hopefully the snow will recede a little bit that we'll get the second half with my proper guest soon. So anyway, today we're going to be talking about a holiday that has really become dear to my heart, especially after this research. It's not one that I've traditionally celebrated, but a lot of my friends have, and honestly, after preparing this podcast, I really think I'm going to start celebrating it. It's surprising, this was meant to be a way shorter podcast than last week's, and now I'm breaking it up into two episodes. So I guess that just shows you how interesting I find this topic. So today's holiday is celebrated around the world on January 25th, but it originated in Scotland, and that's where it's primarily celebrated to this day, and it is Robert Burns Day. So we're here to talk about Robert Burns in this first part, and then in the next episode, we will continue talking about him, the latter part of his life, and then we'll talk about some of the traditions for Burns Day. And if you hear weird sounds in the background, that is Loki destroying the plastic sheeting on my window. She's living up to her name. Most biographies written about people like Burns are written by fans, and they tend to gloss over inconvenient details about their subjects. But there are definitely a few points about Burns' life which should make his fans a little bit uncomfortable. And those are mostly going to come up in part two of this. But, you know, everyone's ambiguous. You know, everyone's got their good sides and their dark sides. And I think it's very interesting to explore what those are. And to have that discussion about who's deserving of merit and who's not, and, you know, especially some historical figures that, you know, Thomas Jefferson was a rapist and, you know, he's hailed as one of the greatest Americans. And I don't think we should forget his sins, but yet we also need to recognize some of his successes. And that balance is, the context is important. And I think if we forget the negative, we turn people into something, you know, into this godlike figure that Thomas Jefferson has become, and we forget who they really are, and that's really harmful. And, you know, Robert Burns was nowhere near the bastard that Thomas Jefferson was. He did have some dark sides, as I mentioned, and I'm gonna confront those directly rather than skirting around them like a lot of the biographies I read in preparation for this did. But that said, I do think he is totally deserving of holiday, and the more I've learned about him, the more I want to celebrate it as well. So keep in mind that I too will have my biases, as everyone does, and I just kind of want to see him as a actual human being. So we'll get the warts and all version of Robert Burns, and hopefully not see him just as some rosy-lipped statue. And I hope after the end of both parts of this podcast, you'll feel like you actually know him. The deeper I got into his story, the more fully round he became to me, and I think that devoting some time to the hypocritical parts of his story is necessary for us to understand him, because one of the main points of Robert Burns' existence was combating hypocrites. And so I think to not call him out on his own hypocrisy when it was there is defeating the purpose for having a Burns Day holiday. But at the same time, I think I would like this guy a lot. I really was impressed by him. I think that this is someone that I would just love to spend some time with and get to know. And so if I had a TARDIS, I would definitely, well, not go back in history. I would not want to be back in history, but I would bring him here and have a chat or something. So buckle in. This is going to be a long one. In the dark days before Bumble and Grindr, people in rural areas had to go to the local fair if you wanted to hook up. That's how William Burness met Agnes Brown, a farmer's daughter. And just about every woman in the story is a farmer's daughter. William was a poor gardener, but he wasn't destitute yet. And he seems to have a really cheerful personality at this time in his life. I get the impression that he was just a good communicator, despite his Scottish brogue, which I'd have some trouble understanding, just keeping it real. And he just seemed to have this intuitive ability to understand and connect with others, and that was a trait which he would pass on to his offspring. He'd later be described as a friend of man and a vice alone to foe, which is a pretty good obit. Similarly, Agnes was described as sagacious, I don't know, which I was surprised to learn isn't an obscure Scottish word, but actually a word that is my version of English as well, and I should actually know it, but it means someone that is keen and perceptive. She was said to have possessed an inexhaustible store of ballads and legendary tales, so I think I'd probably get along with her pretty well too. Also, these were traits that would be inherited by their children. So nature had its way, and soon there were a bunch of little Scotties running around in the yard of their thatch roof clay cottage. On the 25th of January, 1759, a poet was born who would become second to only Shakespeare in world renown. Kind of depending on who you ask, but you're asking me right now. Even Shakespeare wouldn't get his own holiday, so suck it, England. This little bard-to-be was named Robert, or Robbie, as we'll frequently call him. And that was the same name as his uncle and grandpa, since apparently there were only like 12 names in Scotland at the time, and I'm lucky he ended up with one that I can pronounce. I'd describe little Robbie Burns' early years, but he was a kid, and with the exception of Baby Yoda, kids are pretty boring. Basically, sperm and egg, embryo, baby, infant, kid. That's all you gotta know. All the details about teething while nursing, or learning to walk and talk, all those sorts of things that literally 99.9% of us experience, those were so dull that these bits were even left out of the Jesus myth. But I would like to speculate about one thing in his early years. Robbie grew up in a town that was the site of a legendary battle of William Wallace. You remember him of Braveheart fame, and that movie is not exactly historically accurate.
I am William Wallace.
William Wallace is 7 feet tall.
Yes, I've heard. Kills men by the hundred. And if he were here, he'd consume the English with fireballs from his eyes and bolts of lightning from his arse.
But you probably know of William Wallace from Braveheart, so again, we have this debate over does it do more harm than good, making us aware of characters if we're going to learn about them incorrectly. Something to think about. But Robbie would later write, the first two, I can't do it in a Scottish accent. The first two books I would ever read. I'm not going to do this. The first two books I ever read in private, and which gave me more pleasure than any two books I ever read since, were The Life of Hannibal and The History of Sir William Wallace. Hannibal gave my young ideas such a turn that I used to strut in raptures up and down after the recruiting drum and bagpipe, and wish myself tall enough to be a soldier, while the story of Wallace poured a tide of Scottish prejudice into my veins, which would boil along there till the floodgates of life shut in eternal rest. Pretty profound, huh? I find it really interesting that he used the word prejudice in a positive sense, since that's not at all how we use the word today, but I do totally get that nationalism. You know, growing up in the land of Wallace and reading stories about Hannibal, you know, like those are going to fill you with the national pride. And I get the same way learning about Harriet Tubman or John Brown. It just makes me proud to be an American. Kids today, you know, they grow up thinking about Luke Skywalker or, you know, the Avengers. And it's interesting because he grew up learning about real people. And so I'm curious what difference there is in our cultures because of that. It's fun picturing reading history books under sheets like he's a boy looking at a Playboy with a flashlight. Anyway, let's flash forward to when Robbie was 6 years old and just starting his education. Even to this day, the Scottish get a bad rap for being backwards and uneducated, but that only applies to the people on Trump's Scottish golf course. Not only was education highly valued in 18th century Scotland, I read somewhere that their educational rates were higher than anywhere else in the UK at that time, and that includes America, since we were in those figures, since we had yet to fully amorex it. The Burness family really valued education, and Robbie and his brother Gilbert were soon at the top of their class. One teacher, Mr. Murdoch, describes the brothers in a way that, to me, doesn't exactly seem that flattering. Gilbert always appeared to me to possess a more lively imagination and be more of wit than Robert. I attempted to teach them a little church music. Here, they were left far behind all the rest of the school. Robert's ear, in particular, was remarkably dull, and his voice, untunable. It was long before I could get them to diminish one tune from another. Robert's countenance was generally grave and expressive of a serious, contemplative, and thoughtful mind. Gilbert's face said, "Mirth, with thee I mean to live." And certainly, if any person who knew the two boys had been asked which of them was the most likely to court the muses, I would never have guessed that Robert had a propensity of that kind. So yeah, there's that. His teacher basically was saying he sucks. And makes you wonder what side of history your Twitter comments are going to end up on, and if they're going to be recorded later in future podcasts. I get the feeling that this sort of talking behind Robert's back was actually spoken in front of Robert's back, because he wrote this in a 1787 letter. At those years, I was by no means a favorite with anybody. I was a good deal noted for a retentive memory, a stubborn, sturdy something in my disposition, and an enthusiastic idiot piety. I say idiot piety because I was then but a child. Though it cost the schoolmaster some thrashings, I made an excellent scholar, and by the time I was 10 or 11 years of age, I was a critic in substantives, verbs, and particles. In my infant and boyish days, too, I owed much to an old woman who resided in the family, remarkable for her ignorance, credulity, and superstition. I sure hope he's not talking about his mom. She had, I suppose, the largest collection in the country of tales and songs concerning devils, ghosts, fairies, brownies, witches, warlocks, spunkies, kelpies, elf candles, deadlights, wraiths, apparitions, cantrips, giants, enchanted towers, dragons, and other trumpery, which is probably the scariest of the bunch. This cultivated the latent seeds of poetry, but had so strong an effect upon my imagination that to this hour, in my nocturnal rambles, I sometimes kept a sharp lookout in suspicious places. And though nobody can be more skeptical than I am in such matters, yet it often takes an effort of philosophy to shake off these idle terrors. I have no idea what an elf candle is, by the way. A brownie is a good-natured elf which does kind services at night. A spunky is a light that would mysteriously peer over marshy ground. Kelpie is a mythological water creature which would drown wayfarers. Cantrip is a witch's trick. And, what's an elf candle? If you know that, leave me a message. I'd love to find out. Anyway, to me, this really paints a solid picture of the young Robert Burns and just how shitty the educational system has always been. He's a natural poet and finding his mind cultivated by stories and mythology, but at the same time, he's getting whipped at school and told that he's unremarkable because he's not good at singing religious hymns. As with most children in history, he was pretty much considered an adult when he was 14 and put to work. Yay, history. As a 14-year-old child, he would only go to school every other week to improve his writing, but the rest of the time he would work on the farm. By the age of 15, he was described as a principal laborer on the farm because Doctor Who lies in history is a horrible place. You always get that question, if you could go anywhere in time, where would you go? But aside from my curiosity in meeting people like Burns, Oliver Wilde, or Mark Twain, I really don't think I'd do much in the past. As shitty as our world can be now, the past was a horrible place pretty much universally. People died young, doctors made you worse, women and people of color weren't considered, you know, people. I study history because I find it fascinating, but I don't want to go there. I'd rather pop into the future and see if we succeed in creating the society we deserve. But the past with all its horrors, no thanks. I find it pretty miraculous that someone like Robert Burns was able to survive, let alone get the poetry out to us that he was capable of. After a year of hard work, Robbie earned a 3-week vacation, which he spent by going back to school. See if your kids are going to spend their 3-week vacation going back to school. There, he studied English and French. At this point, even his teachers pretty much stopped talking trash about how shitty a student he was, and they began to recognize that he was making good progress. While his childhood was still one of work, as he was plowing, he would be concentrating on plays of Shakespeare or Pope and deconstructing them in his mind. So there was some benefit to the labor as far as developing his poetry. Robbie made his first attempt at writing a poem describing rural beauty. In the grand old tradition of giving Robert Burns insulting compliments, the first poem is described as possessing no great merit as a whole, but it contains some lines and ideas which have done honor to him at any age. Unfortunately, his family moved, and so he was no longer around friends or their books, so his imagination suffered. During those years, he just worked on the farm. One of the things that fascinates me about him at this age is that Burns seems to know he was a poet. He'd read endlessly and write with his friends from the earlier school. Sometimes he'd write a letter and be so pleased with how it sounded that he would actually keep the letter rather than actually mail it to the intended recipient. And this really makes me wonder about the things that we want to be when we're a child. When you're growing up and you're learning all those dinosaur names and you just dream of being a paleontologist, or you want to be an astronaut, or all those lofty dreams kids so often have. And then we kind of have those taught out of us, and we're forced to kind of be pragmatic and think of the real world. I've long thought that maybe those things that we wanted to be as a kid, we spend years thinking about, years learning about, and then those just get flushed away. And I wonder if we did become those paleontologists that we dreamed about, we would have, you know, a good decade of lead time over everyone else that, you know, we're wasting going into more menial jobs. So I really encourage you to consider the things that you wanted to be as a kid and just ask yourself, what would it have been like if I pursued that career? Would I actually still like to do that now as a human being I am now? I think there's some wisdom to the child's mind. Like we catch our interests early, and Robert Burns definitely, he grew up in an age where your options were very limited. Rich or poor, you often basically just, if you were male, followed in the life of your father, and if you're female, you're just chattel that is gonna get married away. And so there's not a lot of social mobility at all. And as far as career mobility, it's really limited and generally stuck within your class. So Robert is basically expecting to be a farmer, but I think he knows in his heart that he's a poet. Just keep that in mind this entire podcast. Like he had this battle between what he had to do to survive versus what he had to do to be the human he knew he was. And that in essence is Robert Burns, that battle, that conflict. In 1766, Mr. Burness got the deal of a lifetime on a lease on a farm called Mount Oliphant. Oliphant? I don't know. I should have looked up how to pronounce these words. It's Scottish, though. It's probably unpronounceable to me. It cost so little because this farm was absolute shit. The soil was pretty much only good for growing rocks, and even then pretty crappy rocks. I get the impression that I could grow more on my 1 foot of Scottish soil than the family could grow on their 70 acres. Oh yes, I have 1 foot of Scottish soil. We'll get into that in the next podcast. In the part two of this, anyway. Gilbert Burns, his brother, would describe the farm as a ruinous bargain. Among the poorest soil I know in any state of cultivation. To the buffetings of misfortune, we could only oppose hard labor and the most rigid economy. My brother, the poet, at the age of 13, assisted in threshing the crop of corn, and at 15 was the principal laborer on the farm, for we had no hired servant. I doubt not but that the hard labor and sorrow of this period in his life was in a great measure the cause of that depression of spirits with which Robert was so often afflicted through his whole life afterwards. Everything I've read just completely corresponds there.
If you want a deal on something Gilbert Burns would not describe as a ruinous bargain, check out our goods and services.
I'm I think growing up poor was something like a scar which followed Robert Burns his entire life, haunting him, and paradoxically keeping him from reaching his full potential. I did just claim that probably the second greatest poet ever never achieved his full potential, and I stand by that. Robert Burns' poetry is great, but I think he could have amounted more if he wasn't stuck. And that's what poverty does, is make you stuck. I work in community development, and I see people struggling to make their ends meet every day. If you come from a rich family with parents who can pay for college, who can help you network, you start out far ahead of anyone else. And yes, it's better than Burns' time, but not for everyone. And people who have a more affluent background have more options when it comes to exploring fields like the liberal arts, while people who come from poverty need to play it safe and pursue careers that are more likely to provide a steady income, even if it's not their ideal vocation. Even if the world would benefit more if they worked in the field that they were best at. I have no doubt that today, there are rice paddies and cobalt mines that are filled with child laborers who would far exceed Einstein, Stephen Hawking, Beethoven, Martin Luther King Jr., or Burns if we gave them an honest chance, and we'd all be better for it. Someday we may achieve the dream of a total luxury space communist society, but that day is not today, and it certainly wasn't in Burns' time. He would eventually be able to pull himself up by his own bootstraps, but many of the decisions Burns would make later in life that ended up ironically returning him to poverty and even causing his early death, those are the sort of vicious cycles I see in America now and in my travels throughout Africa, Asia, wherever. I've experienced many of those in my own life, and the trauma of poverty just, it begets more trauma, and it lasts for generations. The plus side for Burns growing up in such poverty was that he really understood the working person's life. And this was the palette from which he would paint his poems for the rest of his life. His poetry and songs resonate with poor and working class people to this day. Rather than talking down to a farmer, he speaks in a way they can relate to. He gets it, because it's his own life. More than that, he wasn't writing in French or refined British English. He wrote in the people's Scottish dialect, which made them relate to his works all the more and feel a pride in his writing, because it was their writing, it was their words, it was the language they think in, it was the things they saw day to day. I see a lot of commonality with him and Vincent van Gogh. You look at van Gogh's paintings of peasants or potatoes or fields. There's a great one where he painted these prisoners walking around in a circle. Those were the sort of things that the non-elite saw every day. And Scottish people at this time, you know, they're a colony of England, constantly being told they're a subclass. You know, they had the royalty, of course, but it was, you know, they were less than the English. And so here they have someone that is writing poetry that's theirs. That is truly a legacy of Robert Burns. And I think a lot of cultures have someone like Burns. Ilda Lobo in Cabo Verde.
Miriam Makeba
in South Africa. You know, just wonderful singer. And she captured this national identity that was beyond the authorized biography there. That's what Burns did. So I've skipped ahead a bit in our story. Right now, Burns is just a little Scotlet growing up in a dirt farm. He's not written much poetry yet, but he is writing. In addition to poverty, another life-changing event happens at this point in Robbie's life. He discovers girls, and the world will never be the same.
Yep, in 2 minutes, she'd be thinking about me. Poor kid, all alone at a new school. I could only hope someone would be nice enough to say...
Ha ha ha. Ha ha. Nope. If you have any Scottish background, you might see if Robert Burns is in there. In your genealogy. Just saying, there's a good chance. We'll get to that later. One of the first poems attributed to Burns is one called Handsome Nell, and it's about a girl he's crushing on. I'm not going to read it all here because it's teenage romantic drivel. Don't get me wrong, it's a million times better than I could write today, let alone when I was his age, but for the most part, it's kind of crap. Still, it does a great job capturing the feeling of romantic obsession when you're a kid. You read it and you're brought into that experience. You really can see Nell from Robbie's eyes. There is one weird bit in there where he talks about how her gaudy dress causes him to polish his dart. I'm going to assume that's more of a translation error on my part than a double entendre. But I do want to read you the last stanza. "'Tis this in Nelly pleases me. "'Tis this enchants my soul. "'For absolutely in my breast "'she reigns without control.'" That's pretty good. Because most of Robert Burns' poems are written in Scots English, I find it really tragic how much of a hard time I have reading a lot of them. And that's why I chose that paragraph in particular, because it, you know, it touched me, but it also is easier for me to read. And that is definitely one of the challenges with reading Burns today if you're not Scottish. There's just this wealth of beauty, and it's no different than Shakespeare, really. You know, there's so much there, that just wonderful, lofty ideas and just worlds that he paints and just feelings. He paints with feelings. And yet, I don't want to read his poetry with a dictionary, you know, or flipping back the glossary in the back of my poem book. It's frustrating, but that's what we get. And it's worth taking that time because he is a wonderful poet. Alongside his lusty poems about girls, he also wrote runs like The Ruined Farmer. And it is interesting reading a chronological book of his poetry, because so many of his poems will go lust, ruin, lust, ruin, lust, ruin. It's like a, you know, that toy you see in some offices with those balls that just bounce back and forth, you know? He had this joy and then this pain and sorrow, and he captured both without much of a tweet. I am going to read The Ruined Farmer here in its entirety, because it paints a picture of a boy coming of age in poverty that's really the same in his day or ours. It could be read in Detroit. It could be read in Beirut, Somalia. Just people that are trying to make it but are stuck. It really captures the image well. It's also really, really good. And I do give apologies for my complete inability to pronounce some of the Scottish words. "The sun, he has sunk in the west. All creatures retired to rest. But here I sit, all sore beset, with sorrow, grief, and woe. And it's, oh, fickle fortune, oh. The prosperous man is asleep, nor hears how the whirlwinds sweep. But misery and I must watch the surly tempest blow. And it's, oh, fickle fortune, oh. There lies the partner of my breast, her cares for a moment at rest. Must I see thee, my youthful pride, thus brought so very low. And it's, oh, fickle fortune, oh. There lie my sweet babes in her arms. No anxious fear their hearts alarms. But for their sake my heart does ache with many a bitter throw. And it's, oh, fickle fortune, oh. I once was by fortune caressed. I once could relieve the distressed. Now life's poor pittance hardly earned. My fate will scare bestow. And it's, oh, fickle fortune, oh. No comfort, no comfort I have. How welcome to me were the grave. But then my wife and children dear, oh, whither would they go? And it's, oh, fickle fortune, oh. Oh, whither, oh, where shall I turn? All friendless, forsaken, forlorn. For in this world, rest or peace, I never more shall know. And it's, oh, fickle fortune, oh." That poem would prove way too prophetic in Robert Burns' life. One thing that caught my attention was that the words misery and fortune were capitalized, as if these abstract ideas were people. One of the things I think that makes Burns a great poet is his ability to look beyond just a human experience and think of aspects of life such as fortune as having a personality, kind of like the old animist sense, like they were a Greek muse. Mr. Burness seems to have actually understood that his son was something special. At one point he was recorded as saying, "Whoever be left to see it, something extraordinary will come from this boy." So he sent Robbie to school far, far away in distant Kirkoswald. Okay, I say far. It was 12 miles away, but back then it might as well have been 1,200. As most teenagers do, Burns began to stretch his legs and to distance himself from his parents. He started learning how to dance so that he could meet girls, and found a love for interacting socially, which he just couldn't do in the rural communities. I'm going to guess that's pretty safe to say that he discovered drinking about this time, and he definitely discovered sex. He fell in love with a Peggy Thompson who lived next to the school. Of course, he wrote more poetry about her. During this time, his poems are still a mix of describing which girls in his community are hot and how much poverty sucks. It can be hard to spend your time going to school and making love as passionately and often as you want to, so Robbie Burns knew that he'd have to make a sacrifice. So he, quote, ended the school business at Kirk Oswald. So yeah, he quit school so he could fuck more. So kids, next time your parents say that your social life is interfering with your education, keep in mind, Robert Burns had that issue too. When it comes to sex at this age, Robbie seems like a totally normal guy in his early 20s, by our standard. But at the time, his behavior was considered scandalous. At the time, Scotland was infected by a particularly atrocious strain of Christianity called Calvinism. It's still around today, but it was really big then. Calvinists believe that God has a plan, and he's chosen good lives for some people and shitty lives for others, and there's nothing we can do to escape this predestined plan. But we don't necessarily know which track we're on, so even though we can't change anything, we should still pray and sacrifice and behave well just in case. The church was the center of communities back then, even literally. They used shame a lot to try to enforce their way. There was one story about how Robert Burns was being forced to sit in a fornicator's chair at the front of the church so that everyone could know what he was up to. But there were seven other young men up there with him, also being shamed. And that seems to me kind of like they were advertising the guys that were available so that any women who wanted to hook up with these bachelor fornicators would know who to turn to. This was a very good time in Robbie's life, both on getting his rocks off, but also opening up as a poet. The social life that he found himself in served as a muse. One book I read explained this time as ripening his genius. Robbie also joined the Freemasons, and he would remain a Freemason for the rest of his life. Freemasonry fit Robbie very well because a rich person and a poor person were on equal footing within a lodge. And so during lodge meetings, he could at least for a while escape the weight of his economic situation. Also, Freemasons are notoriously critical of religion as a bit of a radical. I say a bit, as a radical. Robbie fit that mold really well. And I think they influenced each other quite a bit. Robbie and his brother founded what they called the Bachelor's Club, which seemed like a frat. It was a bunch of young men who swore an oath that they had loved at least one woman in their life. They would come and drink, and they would talk religion and politics. Robbie would share his poetry, and they had a price limit on the amount that could be paid per day on alcohol and entertainment, so that did serve as a bit of a check and balance to keep things from getting too far out of hand and remain largely in the intellectual realm. When he was 23, Robbie met a farmer's daughter. You can play a bingo game how often that term comes up in this podcast. He fell deeply in love with this woman. He wrote her many letters and four poems, which are about his love for her. But even a silver-tongued devil such as Robert Burns can strike out once in a while, and he was crushed by her rejection of him. History does not recall many women rejecting Burns, so this had quite an impact on him. Robbie, totally depressed, started spending his time drinking with sailors on a coastal village called Griswold, which was full of smugglers and other ne'er-do-wells. He was fascinated by a swaggering riot and roaring disposition. He was also intrigued by their more liberal, relaxed ways and how things like religion, which were treated with suspicion or hatred by these scoundrels. This opened up the doors for lifelong radicalism in Burns. To the best of my knowledge, he would always remain a Christian, but he began to strongly oppose the hypocrisy of most of the organized religion that was epidemic at that time. And he used that great mind of his to openly question much of what was preached, as everyone should, but even to this day, not enough do. According to one book I read about him during this time, he, quote, contracted some friendships, which he himself says did him mischief. I think that is a great turn of phrase there. Contracted some friendships. Robbie decided that if he were going to find a wife, he'd also need a career. So he got a small farm and started growing flax since it was popular in clothing at that time. But disaster struck, and his flax dressing shop was burned to the ground. Robbie describes himself after fire as being, quote, left like a true poet, not worth a sixpence, end quote. So, depressed and broke as fuck, Robbie returned home, only to find that his father was on his deathbed, because sometimes the universe just wants to shit on someone. In a scene disturbingly similar to The Last Supper, one of the things that his father said on his deathbed was that there was one of his children whose future he couldn't look upon without fear. When everyone else was out of the room, Robbie went to his dad and asked, "Oh, Father, is it me you mean?" And his father said that it was. Robbie was crushed, but he would later understand that his father had recognized him as a man of unrestrained passion. While that did him credit as a poet, it could be used to serve the dark side. With William Burness's death, the family moved on to a new farm. It was much bigger at 118 acres, but instead of fruitless dirt, it was mostly fruitless clay. Not an improvement. But Robbie Burns was determined to turn himself into a productive man. Burns describes the plan to turn the farm and himself into a success. "I entered on this farm with a full resolution. Come to, go to, I will be wise. I read farming books. I calculated crops. I attended markets and, in short, in spite of the devil and the world and the flesh, I believe I should have been a wise man. But the first year from unfortunately buying bad seed, and the second from a late harvest, we lost half our crops. This overset all my wisdom." Stressed from his failing crops, lack of a bride, and the loss of his father, Robert Burns kind of snapped one day when he was being shamed by the church yet again. He wrote a poem satirizing the local parish minister. Yeah, that's kind of a big no-no. This became a major controversy and added a lot of fuel to the fire between the two major strains of Christianity, which had trouble coexisting next to each other. Burns just let loose like he was Hawkeye, shooting poetic arrow after poetic arrow, critical of how these organized religions betrayed their communities. And keep in mind, he was doing this as a Christian. His family was not exactly pleased by his behavior, but while Robbie usually listened to their advice, this was just something he needed to do. As an ex-Christian, I totally get that. When you're oppressed by a religion, oppressed by anything, it's really a healing thing to be able to be critical of something that once had power over you in the past. Many ex-Jews, for example, will have a debaptizing ceremony where they'll eat shellfish. Ex-Muslims will do the same thing, tasting bacon for the first time. It's funny how some people who love Burns will get very uncomfortable by this period of his work. Some of them will actually claim that he did more damage to Scotland in this time than good, since his poems did a fantastic job at exposing the hypocrisy of the church and weakening it. But I see that as a major success, so right there it's worthy of a holiday. Go Burns! As Burns turned 25, and he was into his second failed harvest, contrary-wise, he was at his most prolific, writing some of his best and best-known poems. He also was writing more in his native Scottish dialect, which unfortunately makes the poems harder to me to read, but this isn't about my ego. This is about the people of Scotland, and to them, I mean, they deserve a poem written in the language that they think in. Everybody does. One of Burns' most beloved poems was written during this time, To a Mouse. Yes, I said that right, To a Mouse. And my podcat Loki's ears just perked up. Hilariously, the first time I heard this, Scotsman was reading a poem, and the way he pronounced it, it was more like, To a Moose, which really confused me since it describes behaviors I don't associate with a moose. This poem was written when Burns accidentally plowed up a mouse's nest on the farm, and then he paused and he stopped to look at the scene, considering the impact from the mouse's perspective. It's kind of funny that there's this famous great poem about a mouse, but that's what Burns was. He was someone that noticed the things other people didn't, and while some of the poem does feel a little tongue-in-cheek, it really is a fantastic exploration of mankind's relationship with nature and how we can often be harmful without even noticing it. I mean, those are words that are needed now more than ever. It also contains that oft-quoted immortal line, "The best laid plans of mice and men." As I record this, over 1 billion animals have died from wildfires in Australia, untold numbers of species going extinct, and more will be affected by climate change in the future. With this in mind, let me read you the second stanza of this incredible poem. "I'm truly sorry man's dominion has broken nature's social union, and justifies that ill opinion which makes thee startle at me, thy poor earth-born companion and fellow mortal." That recognition that we were part of an ecosystem, that we weren't necessarily above it, but fellows, that was such an incredible concept, and it was something that science was starting to recognize with the theory of natural selection, and Burns was right there at that same time realizing that man is part of nature, not above it. It's really beautiful. As Burns once wrote about fortune personified, he would write many poems to objects or ideas that couldn't actually understand him any more than a mouse could. Looking at his poems, I was able to compile a top 10 list of poems that he would write about non-rational things. Organized here, not by the quality of the poem, but by the unexpectedness of addressing such a thing, here's my top 10 list. Number 10, Address to the Unco Good. To the best I can figure out with my Scots English Dictionary, this means the overly zealous or the strangely religious. And I do put them as not able to understand because these are people that will never leave their religious faith. You know, the 30% of people that will always back Trump. Number 9, Address to the Devil. The devil came up a surprising amount in his poems, and it's interesting to read. It, you know, a lot of it is about the hardship. You know, the devil is more of a concept of misfortune and pain and mischief than it is meant to actually be a person. Number 8, Address to the Woodlark. Number 7, To a Mountain Daisy. Aww. Number 6, To a Kiss. Number 5,
To Ruin.
Number 4, the aforementioned,
To a Mouse.
Number 3, To a Louse. Seriously, he wrote a poem about noticing lice on a woman. I love it. Love it. I've got to read you these first two stanzas. Ha! Where are you gone, ye crawling furly? Your impudence protects ye surely. I canna say, but ye strunt rarely o'er your gauze and lace. Though faith, I fear, ye dine but sparely on such a place. Ye ugly, creeping, blasted wanner, detested, shunned by saint and sinner, how dare ye set your fit upon her? Say, fine a lady, guess somewhere else and seek your dinner on some poor body. I love it. Number 2, the famous Address to a Haggis. We're going to talk about them more in the next podcast. And number 1, Address to a Toothache. Let me again read you two stanzas. My cure upon your venom stang that shoots my tortured gums alang, and though my lung ye is such a twang, we gnawing vengeance, tearing my nerves with bitter pang like racking engines. When fevers burns or agues freezes, rheumatics gnaw or colics freezes, our neighbor's sympathy can ease us with pitying moan, but thee thou hell or diseases, they mock our groans. Despite writing for esoteric audiences such as toothaches and mice, I think all this demonstrates Burns' success at writing for anyone, particularly the working class and the poor. He really describes the experiences of living in a tangible way, and no matter what you're experiencing, you'll find some sort of poem that relates to it. From love and loss, to struggling under poverty, to the joy of watching small birds in a tree, to the loss of a pet. Burns even wrote a poem about politicians that I think about frequently. It's short, so I'll read it in full. On Commissary Goldie's Brains. Lord, to account who dares thee call, or e'er dispute thy pleasure, else why, within so thick a wall, enclose so poor a treasure? Burns understood ambivalence, how you can feel two opposite, irreconcilable emotions at the same time. Sometimes he would describe a scene and then in a later poem take an entirely different point of view. He could go from sacred to profane, but like most of us, spent the majority of his time in the middle. That said, if there was one thing Burns hated, it was hypocrisy. And he spent a lot of his time railing on those he perceived as hypocrites. Above all, his poems and songs focused on one theme beyond anything else, a longing for freedom. I think this is something which makes his works eternally popular, no matter what part of the world you're in. Burns wrote for himself more than anything, but he was getting some local fame, and he would share his poetry and songs with anyone and everyone. Everyone wants to do better than the generation before them, but he had become a struggling farmer just like his dad had been. I think the poetry really kept him going along. And another thing that kept him going along was fucking. And holy fuck did he do a lot of that. When I said earlier that his sexual productivity was about the same as an average young adult, that doesn't slow down as he gets older. In fact, as he grows in fame and has more opportunities, he really is sleeping with an impressive number of people, which is remarkable because, as we've already seen, we're talking about an age where people will be publicly shamed for making love. When someone is as sexually prolific as this poor farmer was, I think it behooves us to stop for a moment and ask ourselves why, so that we can follow his lead and hope for the same outcome. I've thought a lot about Burns in the bedroom, perhaps more than healthy, and I've come up with a few reasons why I think he was so successful. First, there were his looks. Look at a picture of Burns on the internet, or better yet, search for a YouTube video where they took 3D scans of his skull. compared it to paintings, and forensically reconstructed a 3D bust of him. It's really cool, that whole process. You'll find that Burns was quite an attractive man. It's interesting, though, because I'm a straight cis guy, so maybe I'm the wrong person to ask, but I think I'd describe him as being more pretty than handsome, at least as defined by my contemporary culture. I'm not saying he didn't look masculine, but there was a definite feminine softness to his appearance that reminds me a bit of cherubs. But that could be an artifact of the portraiture style at the time. Still, I recently spoke to an author who wrote romance novels set in medieval Scotland, and the men on her covers were way more Chris Hemsworth than they were Robert Burns. Then again, he was a farmer, and so there's a good chance he was way more ripped than his portraits reveal. Secondly, obviously, was his silver tongue. As a poet, he spent a lot of time observing the beauty of the world, and most of the beauty of the world he was looking at were women. He saw a lot of beauty in the lasses. He never hesitated to tell them so. Who doesn't want the best poet of the era describing how sexy he thinks you are for all of perpetuity? There's a lot of women who get lost to history, but Burns records his opinions about many of them. I started making a list of the women he described in his poems and how he described them, but it took several hours and I had 57 people on that list and full knowledge that I'm missing quite a few. That's way too much to include here, but I might release the list as a bonus episode or something. Thirdly, I think he was for the most part genuine. We'll look at a few of the major points of hypocrisy in Burns' life in a bit, but he seems to me like he was an incredibly good guy and someone even I'd enjoy sharing a scotch with. There were several times when even an outside observer centuries later can see that he had truly fallen in love, and even some of those would lead to some serious heartbreak, but good for him for putting his heart out there. So despite all the women he slept with, some of whom he had difficult breakups, he also had quite a few deep friendships with women. And so while he was definitely a philanderer, and I'm, just calling it as it is, a dog when it comes to sex, I think if he lived today in a community like Portland or Austin, New York, where polyamory is common, he would have had much healthier relationships with women. And I think a lot of the problems he had would have just evaporated. Which leads to the fourth and final on my list. There is reason to believe that Burns was a generous lover, if you get my drift. There was one woman he was sleeping with later in his life who was married, and it was beginning to become a bit of a scandal, so she had to leave. I think her husband was overseas, maybe in America or in the Caribbean, perhaps. So she was going to return back to her husband and never see Burns again. But she visited him one more time before she left. Brown chicken, brown cow. Decades later, she would write that that had been the best night of her life, and that in all the rest of her life, he would never be far from her mind in all those years, even though she was with her husband. Basically, Burns was an observer in human nature, and the lassies loved him for it. He would soon use those skills to flirt with an entire nation, but he'd need to experience some more failure first. Well, that's it for part one. In part two, we're going to look at the last bit of Burns' life, at some of his major successes that lead us to why we have a Robert Burns Day, and we're going to look at some of his less than successes. We're also going to look at how we celebrate Robert Burns' Day in the holiday tradition of a Burns Supper, which is a lot of fun, and you might want to see if there's one going on in your community. If we're lucky, the snow will have receded a bit so I can get out on the road and go get my co-host who goes to the Burns Suppers every year. And I think his opinion will be very valuable here. So anyway, until then, I hope you've enjoyed this and we will dig even further. If you've got a holiday in the meantime, let me know what it is. If you celebrate Burns or if you have feelings about him in any manner, let me know. I'd love to hear it. We might air some of your comments on the podcast. Until next time, I'm Cliff Hansen, and this is All Holidays Matter.